on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with one of the sharpest 94-year-olds you're going to find anywhere. Can't you just hear the enthusiasm and the energy in his voice as Jack Leonard describes events that unfolded 70 years ago or even longer? When we left off, he told us about the way he met his wife, Maxine, that when the teenaged War Bond Drive queen walked through the door of his office at Camp Pinedale, he knew she was his. How he worked up the nerve to ask her for a date, and then when he took her home from their first date, he asked her to marry him. Pretty bold guy, huh? We don't get to do this too often, but let's get Maxine's side of the story. What were you thinking when you saw him sitting behind that desk, as he said, with his dark glasses on and his hat on the back of his head?
I thought he was kind of cute, but nothing more than that.
And you were just a teenager. I'm sure you weren't even thinking about marriage.
No, not at all. I had lots of time ahead of me.
What do you remember about that first date? Do you remember what movie you saw?
I should, but I don't. I know we went to the Fresno Hotel and had stuffed tomato salad for dinner, and I had my first taxi cab ride.
And maybe you can give us a sense. I know you've lived here your whole life, but I'm sure Fresno was a little different back then. And here you are, a teenage girl in Fresno, and there were guys in uniform crawling over all over town. It's not like that anymore. What can you tell us about that scene at that time?
Well, there were just a lot of soldiers and a lot of, we only had one downtown. There was no shopping centers, and everything was downtown on Fulton Avenue. So you could go downtown and you could see a lot of your friends and lots of soldiers. And it was kind of fun flirting with them. But we didn't do anything. I think there were a lot of USO drives and dances and whatnot that they had, but I was not allowed to go.
But you were allowed to participate in this war bond drive. Did you feel like that was your way of helping what was going on across the country?
Mm-hmm. I was going out to Fresno State at the time, and I took a summer a job for the summer with civil service, and I continued working because it was fun to make the money. And yes, we had the bond drive, and I sold more than anyone else, and I did feel like I was doing my part, was doing what I could.
So you have this first date with you, and at the conclusion he says, "Will you marry me?" How many shades of red did your face turn in that moment?
I was scared to death. I never had anything like that happen to me, and I was not ready to get married.
What changed your mind? What convinced you that, you know what, this guy's all right, and I guess I'll go for it?
Well, we were standing at the door getting ready to say goodnight at the port of embarkation where I had gone up to say goodbye to him a year later after we had gone together a year. And we were saying goodnight, and I guess we decided to get married the next day. This was on a Friday night, and we decided we'd get married on Saturday. So we got married on Saturday, the day after he convinced me.
Was that a little scary for you to see this guy that you just married heading overseas?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I thought it was the end of the world, and people would tell me, well, you know, you'll eventually see that it's just something that happens. But it was a scary thing. It really was. We had 6 weeks between us from communication, knowing what each other was doing. There was 6 weeks.
It took 6 weeks for a letter to get there.
Mm-hmm. And there was no, I don't think it was air mail, or maybe it was all air mail, but anyway, there was 6 weeks between communication. And he was gone 13 months and came home, and we just have had a nice life since then.
I don't want to blow your cover here, but you just celebrated your 90th birthday, and you had a family from all over come and surprise you for it, and you guys have been married 70 years now. I'm sure some of your kids and grandkids are thinking, it would be great to be married 70 years. What's the secret to a marriage that lasts that long?
He's still in training. So we never know from one day to the next. 70 years isn't long enough to get him in shape, but I'm working on it.
So you just keep giving him something to shoot for, and that's what keeps you guys going?
Absolutely, absolutely. One thing is try to be kind to each other all the time. That's one of the best things I can say to anyone starting out is try to be kind. Not try to be kind, be kind.
There's one thing more that made us stay together for 17 years. Yeah. We both believe in God. And 70 years ago, we made a vow to each other before God, until death us do part. We believed in that vow, and it's kept us together for 70 years. And it's God's will that we're together.
And apparently he's got a lot of work left for you, because Maxine just told us you're still in training. So let's hop back in the time machine to when you went overseas and said goodbye to that young lady you'd been married to for all of 6 weeks. Did you know where you were going or what you were going to be doing?
I knew where we were going and what we were going to be doing. I knew we were going to start in New Guinea. I knew we were going, that's where we were going. And I knew we were going to set up our radio stations, our radio receivers, and we're going to go to work. Copy as much Japanese code as we could and see as much information as we could get. And I knew where we were going. We started in Finchhaven. Well, we were there just a day. We went to Hollandia. We were there for about 4 days. And then we went to the island of Morotai. And the island of Morotai was a bomber pilot training base, not training base, where the bombers flew out bombing Borneo. The Japanese, we'd set our clocks by them. 11 o'clock every night, they'd bomb the airport, airstrip. They were very accurate. They didn't bomb the personnel locations where we were sleeping, but they bombed the airstrip. But at 11 o'clock every night. Except on Christmas night. Christmas night, they surprised us. They came over at 9 o'clock, and we were at a movie. From the movie to where we had our tents, the officers' row of our squadron, there was a big quagmire of mud where the trucks had all turned the corners, and we always walked around it. Well, a friend of mine, we palled around, played volleyball and whatnot. Anyhow, we took off, and we were running for our foxholes because we wanted to get there because AK-AK would come down. It wasn't the bombs we were worried about. We were at about the falling AK-AK. Instead of going around the quagmire, we went through it. Well, Mo, he fell down, rolled over, and got up, and I didn't gain an inch on him. we were just headed for our, when we got to our tent, and we had our, in our tents, we had our own foxholes. We dug them when we got there. I was there until February of 45 when I was sent to Palawan. A detachment of our squadron, we went to, with the 13th Fighter Command, which was on the island of Palawan. The westernmost island of the Philippines. And we were the radio squadron to be there. And we were about 5 miles out from headquarters because that's where we could get the best radio reception. So we set up for about a month. After we got there, no other planes could land because this airstrip wasn't ready, but they finally got it ready. But while we were there, we were fortunate enough that my sergeant and I, he was a Tennessee squirrel hunter. He liked to shoot the baboons and the monkeys and the trees in the Philippines. Then we were walking through the forest one day, and here was a Japanese fire where they'd burned their information. Well, look down, and there was a code book that didn't burn. So we had the Japanese code book. So I got in a B-25 and flew to Manila and gave it to headquarters, and all we had to do then, from then on, made it much easier. From then on, all we had to do was break the code for the day, the encoded, the first code, and everything from then on just fell to pieces.
Well, let's back up a little bit, and let's talk about what your work was like before you found that code book. So you would receive Japanese radio transmissions?
Radio code, Morse code. The radio operators would copy it, and then they would hand me the prints, all the words that they copied. All was in five units, five characters, and it was all in Romaji. It was all Roman characters, but it was in Japanese language. And I would break it down from the code that they had into what I considered was Japanese, good Japanese, and they would translate it.
So you had working under you how many men?
I had 11 Nisei, and I had 12 other guys, but 11 Nisei, they were all radio operators, except two of them were cooks.
So these 11 guys, they're all Japanese-American, born an American, but of Japanese descent, and I imagine many or all of them had families who were probably in internment camps back home. Did they ever discuss that with you?
No, we didn't. We didn't ever discuss it with us at all. They were happy to be with us. They were happy to be in the service, and they were happy to, they that's just one thing. They asked if they could have their meals separate because they didn't want to eat the rations the way we were. They wanted to cook them differently. And so I said, sure, go ahead. So no, there was no discrimination or difference. Right. They were just soldiers, except they were Japanese.
Well, and they had the knowledge of the Japanese language, so that was helpful to you and the work that you were doing. Finding out later the reality of those internment camps and that so many of them were fighting for the very country that had their families basically locked up. Did that give you a greater respect or admiration for the kind of people they were and the work that they did with you?
No, I respected them, the ones that I worked with. But as far as I was concerned, I called them Japs then. And I had an extreme dislike for them. I wanted nothing to do with them. Here, there, or any place else.
Because of Pearl Harbor?
Because of Pearl Harbor. And because they brought us into a war. And I just felt that way until 1993. We got the opportunity to go to Japan on a sister city program, Konami and Kerman. And I didn't want to go because I still had this strong anti-Japanese feeling. And when we got to Konami, we stayed with one family for 3 days and another family for 3 days. Well, the second couple we stayed with were very close friends. We correspond by email. They send us Christmas cards. We send them Christmas packages. And they've been by to visit us 6 times. And me, who had a violent dislike for Japanese, they're the closest friends we've ever had. We've traveled the world and done many, many places and never corresponded with anyone except this Japanese couple. And they've become very close friends.
Was there a moment that everything changed for you? What do you think made that difference? Because that's one extreme to the other there.
Well, I think it was God just touched me. When it first started to change, we were in the Ginza district of Tokyo, and it's a very elite place. And our bus broke down. They were going to pick us up and take us to Konami. So they had to get us on a train and get us to Kamakura, where the big Buddha was. So I looked over in the corner of the train station, and here is the committee. 7 people making arrangements to transport 29 Americans from Tokyo to Kamakura on the train. Well, I watched them talking. Oh, they're so animated. Just watching them talking and moving their hands and everything, it just kind of tickled me. It tickled me. And I think the Lord says, hey, they're good people. So I started changing then at the station. And everything turned, it was so warm. Everything was so light and so warm and so friendly that you couldn't help but like them. And it just changed. I did.
And I'm glad that you shared that, because I know you're not alone as someone who carried that dislike or that hatred for understandable reasons, the way the world was then and the way America was attacked. But being able to go now 20 years with this newfound appreciation and forgiveness, if you will, or affinity for the Japanese people, do you feel like a burden has been lifted? I mean, how would you describe the difference between how you felt before and how you feel now?
Well, I just come to recognize that the Japanese are no different than we are. They're people just as we are. They have the same feelings that we have. They feel a little differently about different things, but they still have feelings. They love, they hate, they do work, they do everything else. They're just like us. They just have a different color and a different language. That's about it.
Well, I know we're bouncing around from different eras here, back and forth, and I had asked you what it was like before you found that code book. So now let me follow up. You guys have that code book, and what a serendipitous find that is in the embers of a fire to find an intact code book that saves you so much work. How different were things after you had that code book? How much work did it save you, and what kind of strategic difference do you think it made?
I don't know if it made any strategic difference, but it made our job a heck of a lot easier, because once we determined the first code, well, then all we had to take then was just take the Romaji and have our Japanese soldiers, our Nisei, translate it. That's all we had to do. It was simple. And we didn't have much Japanese to copy. They were so busy in Okinawa, other parts of the country, that we didn't have much. So they sent me to Brisbane, Australia on a wrist leaf.
And as far as all these codes that you did intercept and that you did pass on, did you ever get a sense of what the content of some of those transmissions were? I mean, were we talking about troop movements or where things were going to be positioned, or what do you think those transmissions were about?
Well, I know some of them were from pilot to pilot, and they were about where they were going, whether they were going to Borneo, whether they were going to Okinawa, where they're going to go, whether they're going to come to the Philippines again. But we found out where they would, if there was a Navy ship they were going to go after, we would discover that they were going after a Navy ship, but we wouldn't know the Navy ship, we wouldn't know the name of it. But in Japanese, we would know that they were flying to bomb something and try to guess where they were going.
And as far as being in harm's way, I mean, you described the bombings on Morotai that you could count on like clockwork and how they came early on Christmas. But even there at Palawan, were there times where you felt like your life was in danger or some danger was going to come your way?
Only once. Our radio receiving set, our trailer, was probably about 150 feet from my headquarters office, where I sat and did my work. Well, this one day I was sacked out, taking it easy because there wasn't anything to do. And a Japanese soldier, an enemy, took his gun, it was a 25 caliber, I think, and shot the operator, Sadar Nisei, and it went through his back and knocked off the end of 3 of his fingers. And, of course, when I first heard the guns, I took off and got my boots on and went out there. He turned around and he emptied his clip into the office. Had I been sitting in my chair, he would have shot me. I would have got shot too. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, there's no one there to get any shot. So I grabbed the sofa pads and put them in front and back, got in the back of the Jeep and had the sergeant drive me to the hospital. And
yeah, so you took care of that wounded man under your command, knowing that you too could have been wounded or killed if you'd been in your office. It's a pretty sobering thought, but there's a funny twist to that whole story too, and we're going to save that for right after this break when Hometown Heroes comes down the home stretch after this.